Welcome to episode 19 of season 9 of Move Around Minute, the daily podcast, where we yippee-ki-yay our way through the Die Hard duo, Die Hard 4 and 5, 5 minutes at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me is Alan Sanders of the, guess it, it's the Alan Sanders Show. Welcome back, Alan.
Thanks, Rob, man. Really appreciate you. Let's put it this way. Not like you fit me in at the last minute, but I was able to make this happen at your last minute. And I know it's a pain, but thank you for working with me.
Well, I've known you for 9+ seasons. So, you know, I know what to expect. So that's fine.
Well, you know, it would be so much easier if I had a spouse who understood that sometimes it's fun to just record stuff about movies, not necessarily about world politics.
Yeah, I think we both fit into that category, but that's fine. You know, my wife still can't understand after I've done, you know, over 1,100 or almost 1,100 episodes, she cannot understand how I can spend time just talking about movies with people for so long. And
yep.
She never will get it, and that's fine. You know, I don't fault her for that. She has the things that she likes doing that I can't understand, and that's it. You know, it's a give and take, but. You know, at least she gives me the window to take care of it. You know, she doesn't say you can't do it. You know, she just doesn't want me doing it all the time.
Well, I can appreciate it. In fact, you know, I always have these on the calendar, and that's the funny thing about she's actually out of town, which makes it easier for me to do this. But she said, "Oh, I saw your calendar, so because you have so much free time, here's a list of things that also need to get done." I'm like, "You gotta be kidding me."
That's considered free time?
Yeah, see, this is a waste of my time, according to her. I could be doing more productive things.
Okay. I'm very familiar with that conversation. So, you know, it's a conversation that, you know, thankfully we love them for other reasons, not because they hate what we like doing in our leisurely time. Yeah,
absolutely.
I think that's what it basically comes down to. Okay, so why don't we start off, as always, with telling me your history with this movie. Do you remember when you first saw it? Do you like it? Do you not like it? I mean, that, you know, we're open. I'm open to every part of every opinion regarding that, you know, and just wait until we get to Die Hard 5.
Oh, geez. So, the original trilogy, which we've done and you've had me on, and I really appreciated being on every single one of your seasons, but certainly the original Die Hard 1, 2, and 3, those may be one of the best trilogies of all time. I mean, they're ultimately rewatchable. Obviously, we dove into it a minute at a time. I didn't get to see this movie in the movie theater. At least I'm pretty sure I don't have a memory of being in the movie theater, but I remember renting it. And I remember saying at some point, we've reached an era where we're doing spectacle with CGI and digital effects for the sake of spectacle. It doesn't make sense anymore. It starts to feel like by the end of the movie, the stunt work and the stunt pieces that have to do with the F-35, I was just going, okay, I'm done. I am mentally out of this movie. You've taken me. It was good to a point, and then I felt like I couldn't like it anymore. It's not a horrible movie, but it is so far below the first three Die Hards for me that I almost don't want to think of it as a Die Hard movie. It's Bruce Willis, but I wish it was called something else. I wish, right, it was just a different movie.
Now, I completely understand what you're saying about that. And I agree with it. I've said this many times and I will say it many more times till we finish this season. I look at the first three movies as the Die Hard trilogy. Those are John McClane movies, and 4 and 5, they've tried to turn him into an action hero, which just doesn't work as well. It's still fun. It's great revisiting the character and stuff like that. But these aren't Die Hard movies per se, in my opinion.
No. I do appreciate we get introduced to a young Timothy Oliphant. At the time, I don't think a lot of people realize where he would go as an actor. And he does play a good bad guy. The hacker, the kid who... I could never get out of my head, wait, that's the geek from Galaxy Quest. And I know they grew his hair long and they tried to give him a sense that he was maybe a little more rough and tumble. I just saw a kid who didn't know what he was doing in this movie.
Well, he did know what he was doing. He what he was doing was hacking. The hacking aspect he's great at.
Yeah, and I don't know. It was a pill, and it's not right to do this, but we sometimes do. We will sort of typecast people based on the first time we've seen somebody or how they impacted us. And I could never see him feeling, it didn't look like he was comfortable playing the sidekick to an action hero.
Right. Okay.
I just, as far as, the actor was Justin Long. He had kind of that geeky, goofy. Yes. You could make him a hacker, but I mean, look at Kevin Smith. You have him set up as Warlock. He's quote, a hacker, but you're not putting him in the action set pieces. You're not trying to turn him into the co-leading man. And I just feel like Justin Long couldn't pull that off.
Right. Okay. I agree. And also I've said this before, that it feels in some ways that the idea here was to sort of pass the baton over, and like in other franchises, mainly Indiana Jones, it just didn't work.
Yeah. It's got that similar feel. You put the young kid who was, I think, a rising actor at the time.
Yes,
he'd done Jeepers Creepers. He'd done, obviously, a Galaxy Quest. I don't know what he's done since or where he's been, but it just feels like this was an attempt to maybe kick him up to the next level, and it didn't work.
Right. Right. I agree. It is what it is. That's what we got.
Mm-hmm. Now, I will tell you this. I love the fact that they bring in the element of Lucy McClane. I mean, bring in the daughter. Nice, it's not like it's a new storyline, but I liked that element. Again, I like Timothy Oliphant as a bad guy. The premise, especially when it first came out, when we were getting really into the whole internet era, cyber hacking, cyber security. I know it's a product. It's definitely dated because of the technology. When you look at using your keyboard style and old kind of open keyboard flip phones. We're not even in the smartphone era yet. The premise I thought was an interesting one, but I think they moved away, and we're kind of treading what you already said. They moved away from what made the Die Hard movie so good, and that's just an ordinary guy who's put in extraordinary circumstances, not a guy doing comic book action sequences.
Right. Exactly. They attempted something, and I don't think it worked. That's what it comes down to. But again, looking back, it's always nice to see John McClane. Right. Digital era, you can go back and just rewatch the first three. You don't need the fourth one for that perspective.
This to me is, and we I fault this a lot with. There was an era of films where, again, the CGI. What can we push the boundary? This was where we had too much icing, not enough cake.
Correct. I think that's a good way of looking at it. But that's what they give us. So you got to take what you get. For better or worse. That's what it comes down to. Okay, so episode 19 begins with John trying to reassure Farrell, and ends with Farrell trying to shut that system down. So, we just finished yesterday talking about the Warlock episodes, and they left Warlock's house, the only place in Baltimore with a light on during the blackout. And then John goes out and is about to get into a car. Now, do you remember how they got to Warlock's house?
No.
They took a helicopter. Okay, so then the question remains, where's this car from? Whose car is this?
Well, we don't have to know, right? It's just somebody's car they're just taking.
Well, again, it's Warlock's mom's car. that's the bottom line here.
Okay.
But they never asked Warlock for the keys or anything like that. So it's a little strange. And maybe that was like a cut line, from the original script or something like that. But I just find it really funny that, we just see them in a, getting into a car. Do you have any idea what type of car this is?
It's definitely older, and I can't tell the model. But no, I do not know the model, because even when they pan across the grill, I don't see a hood ornament or anything. It's just a steel or a chrome grill, so no idea.
Okay, so it is a 1962 Lincoln Continental.
Mm.
Okay, and do you know how much it would cost to buy a Lincoln, a 1962 Lincoln Continental right now?
Oh, right now versus?
Yeah, I don't care how much it would have cost back in 1962. In 2025, if you want to go and try and find, you know, a Lincoln Continental to buy.
Well, I know those were boats. Those were super huge. The gangsters loved them. Gosh, because it's classic. I'm going to guess, I don't know, like 50, 60K?
Okay, well, you can buy one anywhere between the range of 24,000 to 275,000. But
oh geez.
But 60 is the average of what you would.
Okay.
So you're right on the nose on that one. You know, if you want to get one that's in good condition, you can get one for about 60,000. So
yeah, that falls in that category of now classic or collector car.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, it's a car that they started making in 1939, and they stopped producing them in 2020. The Continentals. I'm not going to get into the whole history of which cars and how, you know, the different kinds and stuff like that, because I'm not a car person. You are more of a car person than I am, that I know. But you know, I don't even know if you're a car person to the extent that you would know, you know, the different models of Lincoln Continentals over the years.
No, I would not.
I'm pretty sure it's a Lincoln Continental. I think that the Saturday Night Live did a skit. They did like a commercial where they said that the riding in I'm pretty sure Lincoln Continental in this particular car is so smooth that you can do a circumcision in the back. You know, and they have like a rabbi, you know, with a little baby getting into the car and stuff like that.
Now, I do know it was considered obviously a huge luxury car. It was a very big car. And, you know, Lincoln was kind of known for being more of that luxury. And so, like, you look at the Lincoln Navigators today in the SUV class, it's like one of the higher end of the big three. If you're not buying, let's say, foreign, like a Mercedes or Acura. But as far as an American made company, Lincolns are pretty high end.
Well, especially if after 63 years, it's still going to cost you $6,000 to buy one.
Right. I mean, my Ford that I just got, a used Ford F-150, which was 4 years old, the original sticker price was right around $60,000 for a brand new 2025 truck. And I can't even imagine spending that on a vehicle that's 60 plus years old just for the nostalgia of it.
Yeah, seriously.
I'm like you. I used to be more into cars when I was a lot younger. Then I started realizing, you know what? All I want is I want a good, reliable, comfortable ride with a pretty decent system, like sound system, because I'm in it. If I'm going to be in it, I want to be able, if I'm listening to music, if I'm listening to radio, I want to have a quiet enough that I can hear it and enjoy it. But I'll drive a car now until the wheels fall off. I don't think about I need new every 3 years or every 5 years. And I don't care. I mean, it's a mode of transportation for me.
All right. Okay. Well, it also, I guess, goes with the same idea that you know, they don't make things as sturdy as they used to. You know, so, you know, cars, you know, older cars are more reliable for the long run than newer cars. But newer cars obviously have a whole bunch of stuff that you're not going to find on an old car. You know, you're not going to be able to get, you know, you're not going to have an old car with an alarm that's going to work well, or it's going to have, you know, Bluetooth or Wi-Fi or any of those other things. So
Or like with mine, I got completely spoiled, because my car that I finally replaced it with was about 20 some years old, and so I knew of cruise control because we had it, but I've never had adaptive cruise control with steering. So my truck, I could put it in and it will literally stay in my lane and maintain speed. And if they're slowing down, it'll slow down. If people pick up, it literally will drive itself. It's the coolest thing in the world.
Wow.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'd be a little scared to completely rely on cruise control,
Yeah.
for a long
Well,
period of time. Just for a few seconds here and there, okay, fine. But
here's the thing, and they must have figured it out that people like me were going to see how good it is. It senses if you're taking your hands off the wheel, if you're not there in control, and it will turn itself off. So you have to keep your you have to maintain hands on the wheel.
Okay. It's not something that lets you continue without that. Okay,
Yeah, it's not
that's
like the
important.
Tesla Auto Drive. Not yet.
Okay. I still remember, I think it must be about 4 years ago, I was driving with one of my uncles, and he was telling me that he got a new car and it has cruise control, and he was showing me, look, you can take your hands off the wheel and it'll keep going straight. And I was like, okay. And then I was like, but maybe you should put your hands back on the wheel.
You know what? It's weird. The first, like my wife, I told her to try it. We were in the truck and I was like, watch, when we get into traffic, it'll start slowing down. And then we started to see traffic and she saw brake lights and she immediately wanted to hit her brakes. I was like, what? Why'd you hit them? We weren't catching up yet. She said, I can't trust it. I have to be in control.
Exactly. I can completely understand that. Makes a lot of
It's a,
sense.
it's a mindset. Believe me. 'Cause the first time I was doing it, I was like, I had my foot hovering over the brake. Like, okay, I'm going to watch. Let's see. Will it slow down? It's amazing, dude. It is. But anyway, I know that's not what we're here to talk about, but you're right. I mean, the functionality of today's vehicles blow away the past. But I do also think, to comment what you said, there was a push for the last several years that just because it's a domestic car doesn't mean it has to be, only last 6 or 10 years. I've gotten a lot of mileage and a lot of years out of the cars I've had. And so, a lot better than, let's say, the cars that were made in the 80s and maybe even somewhat in the 90s that would get just a bad rap.
I mean, I had a car that I bought brand new in '97, and it lasted 13 years, and I put a hell of a lot of miles on it. I don't think I'm ever going to have a brand new car that I'm going to last that long because I now lease. It's easier. This way, I get a new car every 3 years, but it's not mine to keep.
Yeah, if you're not driving a lot, but now for me,
No, I
I
drive a
mean,
lot. That's why it's better for me to lease, because this way, every 3 years, I have a newer car that's more reliable. I don't have to worry about issues.
yeah, but you have that thing that I hate, the car payment, and I hate having a car
Yes,
payment.
I understand that. I hate it also, but if you buy a car, you're gonna have a car payment usually anyway. The odds are you're probably gonna have to finance it anyway.
Oh yeah, no. I'm gonna do the same thing like I did with my wife's car. We bought one. I took out a 4-year loan. We paid it off in 2, so that way we don't have a car payment. And then I'm gonna do the
Exactly.
same thing with the truck. I'm just gonna pay it off as fast as I can because I hate. It feels like a waste of money. It's just like money going out. I know I had to pay back a loan, but I hate having debt.
I completely understand about that. So John and Farrell are standing on other sides, on opposite sides of this car, and John says to him, "Thanks for your help." And he gets in the car and starts the engine. And then Farrell says something really weird. He says, "I wouldn't bet on you either, but I figured I'd lend a hand." I think he goes back to what you were saying before, that they wanted to try to make him seem like more of a sidekick who's willing to try and help out. But it just doesn't work as well. It's not as believable with it's like, where did this guy just grow a pair? After being at Warlocks.
It's struggling, and I guess that's my problem. It's not his fault. He got cast, and I guarantee you, if it was me, I would do as much as I could to try to own the role. It just doesn't feel right.
And then John just looks at him, smirks, and goes, "Okay, buckle up." And then they start driving away. And as they're driving away, we see the overview shot of the neighborhood, and we see that literally Warlock's house is the only house that has any light on in the whole area, which is just funny to see. And then the shot changes, and we see someone using a crowbar to open an elevator door, which again, once again, they're giving us a little bit of nostalgia shots of previous stuff from Die Hard. So, here we have them opening up an elevator door, And they're using a crowbar. Now, what do you know about crowbars?
You know, I swear, I've done this for you. I don't know how many years we've been doing this. I don't know. This is our ninth season, and I'm like, I still can't figure out what you're going to ask me when you send me my minutes.
This is the fourth.
I,
This is the fourth. We've been doing this for, I've been doing this for 4 years. So there you go.
I know it's a, obviously it's an old tool. It's been around for a long time. It's your basic pry bar. So in terms of calling it a crowbar, I don't know the history of the term crowbar, but I know it goes back, I mean, shoot, like 17 something, 1700s, as a blacksmith kind of, like a pry bar to help open things, or you know, later they added the little claw to be able to pull nails out, and to be able to kind of use the rocker of the end to kind of use as leverage to kind of pry things open. So, but I don't know the history beyond. I just know what it is and that we've had it for a couple hundred years easy.
Okay, well, it actually goes back even further than you think. The first use of it is in the 1400s,
Oh,
and
wow.
it's even in Shakespeare. And I know you're a big Shakespeare fan.
Yeah.
In Romeo and Juliet,
They didn't call it a crowbar though.
what do they call it?
It was a, I thought it was called it a pry bar.
They called it an iron crow.
Okay.
Okay, I mean the reason it's called a crowbar is because of the shape of it. It looks like a crow because on the way it has on the top, the curved area on the top and the bottom has the I guess the gooseneck, I guess you can call it. Right. So there are a lot of different names for a crowbar. It's called a wrecking bar, a pry bar, like you said, a pinch bar, a prize bar, also known as a gooseneck or a pig bar, and in Australia it's known as a jemmy. So it's basically a lever consisting of a metal bar with a single curved end and flattened points, used to force two objects apart or gain mechanical advantage in lifting. Often the curved end has a notch for moving nails, as you said. And they're sometimes also referred to as utility bars. Don't, like I said, it was mentioned in Romeo and Juliet. It's also mentioned in Robinson Crusoe. It talks about the fact that Robinson is missing. He doesn't have a pickaxe, so he uses a crowbar instead. And the quote is, "As for the pickaxe, I made use of the iron crows, which were proper enough, though heavy." And there's a whole bunch of different types of crowbars. You have an alignment crowbar, which is known as also as a sleeve bar. You have a cat's claw pry bar, which is known as a cat's paw, a digging pry bar, a flat pry bar, a gooseneck pry bar, a heavy duty pry bar, a molding pry bar, and a rolling head pry bar. So yeah,
Wow.
there's a lot of different types of pry bars, as you said.
Well, you've done your homework, sir.
Yes, I have, as always.
Well, I definitely have the crowbar, the crow neck, or the, what do you call it? The crow neck? Is that what they call it when it's got the curved?
The gooseneck.
That's the gooseneck. I've got a couple of versions of those. Those are super handy to have if you're doing any kind of projects around the house or home improvement. But I also have a smaller one that was good for doing some removing the floor tack. Like if you're taking carpet out of a room and you know you put the little tack strips along the corners, those are usually nailed down, and you could use these to kind of wedge underneath, pry it up, and then use the curved part to pull the nail out. So yeah, I got a couple versions of these tools because they're really, really handy.
Okay, that makes sense. That's what you need them for.
Now, the number of times I've needed to pry something, like when I was disassembling pallets and things, getting that long, I've got a long with the gooseneck that gets you that leverage you need to kind of open it up and pull the boards apart.
Very cool. So, all right, then we get to see who's actually opening it, and we see someone slouch down, and this is an actor named Yorgo Constantine, who has 62 IMDb credits. Most of them are not things that are really recognizable. The one thing that stood out for me besides this movie was that he was also in Fast Five, you know, one of the Fast and the Furious movies. And he goes, FBI, ma'am, Jersey Field office. And then we see that it's obviously it's Lucy, and she goes, mind if I see your ID? He goes, not at all. And he takes out an ID, shows it to her. His name is Robert Russo. And she like laughs and then says, my dad's a cop, force of habit. He goes, your father sounds like a very smart man. And again, you know, after seeing yesterday's episode, we know that you know, this is obviously one of Gabriel's men, because Gabriel said mm-hmm. that he's going to be sending someone over there. We also happen to notice, actually, I'm going to hold off on that last thought for just a few more minutes, but it's very interesting how quickly they're able to get there, and the fact that he says that he's in the Jersey Field office. Because mm-hmm. actually, you know what? What the hell? We mentioned yesterday that we actually see that according to the GPS they have on Lucy, she's in Baltimore, according to the map that they show us. So mm-hmm. she might be a little confused if she's in Baltimore and someone from the Jersey Field office has shown up. But I guess it's all just you know, they never expected anybody to do the research that that we do here.
Well, I would say that if of all the diehards, the script itself does play fast and loose with some things just to keep the action going. I don't know that they were paying as close attention as some of the other scripts that they had prior to this.
Well, again, they didn't expect someone like us to people mm-hmm. like us to be paying attention to it either. And then
now, did you when he shows his like, you know, little ID badge, photo ID, were you would that I guess the question is, I know that when you're inside of like, because I've got one of those inside the radio station, you know, there's a security, it's got my picture and it's one of those little badges that's in a little plastic thing. But when she said, can I see some identification? I was kind of wanting, like, show an actual
badge,
your badge, you know, like literal, not something that you could have just printed out at home and put in a plastic sleeve.
Yeah, seriously, it looks really fake. Again, but she's in a situation where, she doesn't feel the need to assume that someone's going to be trying to figure out.
Right.
You know, so, okay, he shows me this thing that you can easily print out. You know, it's similar to obviously what Trey printed out a long time, you know, many, many episodes ago, you know, for Mai, you know, the dearly departed Mai. It's a similar FBI badge that they gave her.
Mm-hmm. It just feels like they make a point of her, or her character makes a point of saying, sorry, you know, my dad's a cop. Well, then shouldn't you have been asking for something a little bit more official?
That's right.
it threw me off because I was like, wait a minute. Why wouldn't you be wanting to see like an actual badge or badge number or his actual FBI ID, not a little key card or a little entry thing that's just allowing you inside the building?
Yeah, absolutely no clue. but you're right, it just doesn't make any sense why Lucy would act this way.
Mm-hmm.
And then the shot changes after she gets out of, or after they start trying to help her out of the elevator, and we see that John and Farrell are continuing their road trip. You know, you would expect them to be playing loud music or something like that, you know, just as they're going along. And you can also see that John's driving without headlights on, which obviously makes sense. And then John says to him, he says, kid, can you get Bowman? He goes, yeah. And then he pulls out his little PDA, tries to figure it out, and realizes that, you know, they it doesn't work. He goes, it's completely dead. Gable must have shut down all the satellite links. Shit. So mm-hmm. it's actually very funny because, like, earlier, you know, we had a point where his phone was dead. And then John said to him, do you think that you know, they turned off all the cell towers or whatever? No, he says, well, you ran out of battery. And at that point, it wasn't the battery there. It was the cell towers. And now it's something else. And, you know, they're once again trying to show us that John is not as technically advanced as one would probably want him to be in this day and age type of thing. I don't know.
Yeah, I think part of the premise of I mean, I guess if you're looking at it as a movie, John represents the old school analog regular telephone. Remember in the very first movie when he's told to go look up Holly's name on the digital screen, and he's That's just right. like, well, this thing also, you know, would it order something up for you? Mm. So you've got the idea of a guy who is barely.
Well, they'll find your zipper if you need to take a leak. Take a leak.
Yeah. Yeah. And then now you've got, and the quote, his foil in this case, you know, the guy that was with cybersecurity, the guy that, you know, Timothy Oliphant.
Gabriel.
You know, right. Yeah. We're talking about, you know, fully versed in the internet, Wi-Fi connectivity, all these systems, how they integrate, how you secure, you know, cyber encryption, all these different things. So yeah, it shows that John's completely out of his technological element, which I think, again, conceptually could have worked on the movie level, but they didn't dive deep enough into story. They just wanted more, too much spectacle. So,
right.
So here's the thing that bugs me about this is, you know, just because you write something doesn't mean it's a reflection of the technology of the day. And there's, based on what we're seeing here, there's no way this little phone plugging, you know, just hook it to a cigarette lighter for power is hooking to satellites. I mean, the kind of tech you would need and the size of a battery pack to at this time when this movie's made, that doesn't even make sense in the movie. It's like, it's a detail that they just tell the audience, let it go by. Most people probably would have gone, oh, wow. Okay. But it bugs me for somebody who was in this business.
That's right. That's the thing. I would say that in 2007, when this came out, most people were not as computer savvy as most of us are these days. You know, so here, 18 years later, you know, you can look at it and say, you know, I know that you worked at IBM at the time, so you probably were a little, you know, more tech savvy at the time than most people were. Like, I would have bought that idea, even though in 2007 I knew a lot about technology. I wouldn't have known anything about satellite technology, so I would just bought the idea, you know, from that perspective. I wouldn't say, okay, that's impossible. I'd be like, okay, it's very cool that there's the, you know, this hacker that now knows how to do this type of thing, you know, that type of thing. But nowadays, looking at it, you're right. You know, you say, oh, come on.
Yeah. And maybe that's another reason why when I saw it the first time, I was like, oh, come on. Just because you write it doesn't mean it's so. You know, and that's the part that when you start going, okay, now it's becoming fantasy. Now it's becoming, it's so far away. And when you're doing fantasy, now you can do really stupid stunts that would defy, like, I guess what I loved about the first three Die Hard movies, the stunt work is still believable. Like, you believe that they could survive what they're going through.
Correct.
And then this movie, you just keep getting reminded that they didn't really, it's too unrealistic.
Well, like I said earlier, it's more of an action type movie than a Die Hard movie, and therefore, you know, they bend the realm of reality when it comes to action pieces in the movie. You know, having a guy jump out of a helicopter and land on a car and be fine, that's wow. And then later on to have a truck, let's even talk about that same scene, you know, shooting a car into a helicopter also, you know, is completely impossible. And then, you know, what we're going to get to in the next, you know, next week with the whole thing with the truck trying to, you know, get out of the way of the F-35, and also right. eventually taking out the F-35. That's just all, you know, completely right. Unrealistic from that perspective.
Yeah, it's this part where you just go, why? What? I don't want. Well, you may like it better. You get to that point where you're like, what? Why am I watching this?
That's right. No, you're watching it because it's fun. It's just not a Die Hard movie anymore. That's what.
You know, and I know those weren't my minutes, but you know, when he jumps through the truck and he lands and he ends up on the back of the F-35 and the F-35 spinning, I'm like, they did it so much better with Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Yes, that is true. And that was 14 years before this one came out, when True Lies, you know, mm-hmm. so, yeah. But I like the, you know, by just listening to what Farrell is saying here, they're showing that Gabriel has starting to figure stuff out, you know, even more. You know, his original idea was not to take out the satellites, and now he's turned them off. I guess he realizes that that's what Farrell's been using. I don't know. You know, I guess it's just another way for him to make sure he has total control over everything that's going on. So, you know, it gives us a little bit more information about the way that Gabriel is dealing with all this stuff. So, and then John and Farrell continue their conversation, and Farrell says, "Well, look, I'm really sorry about Lucy, man. About all of it. It's my fault you got into this. This wasn't your fight." And then John looks at him and goes, "You got nothing to be sorry about." which, again, shows that when John's in it, he's in it. He doesn't really care. And then the shot changes and we're back with Gabriel, who's, you know, in his, he's in an office looking at a whole bunch of computer screens. A lot of stuff going on those screens. It's not close enough for us to be able to tell what it is, even though I know what it is, because we saw this earlier when it showed all the different banks that they're transferring the money from. You know, that they're getting into the Federal Reserve banks and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So you take a look at it, and then we hear the elevator ding, which again is a callback to Die Hard with the whole thing, and then. The door opens and we see Russo walking into the walking into this office, grabbing Lucy, which then makes you wonder, okay, first of all, A, how did they get there so fast after just one little scene? Because John doesn't have as long of a drive. You know, you have mm-hmm. here we have a drive. They have to go from Camden to Baltimore. You know, how long do you think the drive would be from Camden, New Jersey to Baltimore?
If there's nobody on the road?
Nobody on the probably, road.
I don't know the geography so well, but I'm going to guess at least 30 minutes.
It's an hour and 45 minutes.
Holy crap.
Okay. Yeah, there's no way they got there that quick. Not at all. And obviously something happened during the course of this. Because, you know, she gets out of the elevator, starts screaming, "Let go of me, you bastard." And then he mm-hmm. says, "This bitch is a handful." Now, again, what happened in the last minute of this movie that she figured things out, even though, again, you know, I'm assuming that Russo would have had some sort of plan of what to tell her, that we've now rescued you and we're taking to your father who's in Baltimore or something like that. I don't know.
Yeah, yeah. It's one thing that you can get somebody to buy along for a 10 or 15 minute car ride, but when you're in the car for almost 2 hours, you're going to have some conversation. So at what point did she figure out, where are you taking me?
That's right. And he goes, "Oh, we're going to Baltimore. Your father's there." Oh, okay.
But But no, what did she do? Like, what made her suddenly realize I'm being scammed? Because if she was told the lie, I mean, I know we're playing what if now because we have no idea.
Right.
If she was told, "Hey, it's going to be a bit, you know, buckle up. We have to get into Baltimore." Then why is she fighting? If she thinks she's going somewhere. So what tipped her off that she suddenly realizes he's not real FBI?
That's right. No clue. She just said, "Wait a second. that ID he showed me just isn't really, doesn't," she had 2 hours to think about the fact that the ID is not realistic enough.
Ding. Wait a second.
That's right. And then she basically punches him in the face. And he's not very happy about that, obviously. And Gabriel just grabs her and throws her into a chair to make sure she doesn't do anything. And then Russo comes over and smacks her really, really hard.
Mm-hmm.
And Gabriel's not very happy about this. He looks at Russo and says, "You gonna be all right?"
Well, I took that as, and by the way, I think this is why, even though he's a bad guy here and he's kind of playing a two-dimensional bad guy, it's those little moments like right there where you get that snarky sense of humor and the almost like the twinkle in his eye when he's like, "You're going to be okay, girl punched you in the mouth. Do I need to get you something?" And I think that's what has been part of Timothy Oliphant's growth as an actor and getting into other series, you know, obviously Justified and Deadwood. Mm-hmm. I just think that that's that little moment where you go, okay, there's a lot more to the actor, even though the character was written fairly two-dimensionally. The actor was adding those little touches.
Yeah, I agree with you on that. I like it. I mean, again, let's look at it this way. How would you rank the five Die Hard villains?
Oh, well, Alan Rickman, number one.
Okay.
Then his brother, number two.
Okay.
I would say, well, see, I want to like Timothy Oliphant because I like him as an actor, but I would have to say it's going to be the
Colonel Stewart.
The Colonel Stewart, yeah, in number two. So basically 1, 3, 2, then 4 and 5.
Right. Okay. That's exactly how I would rank it also. You know, because as much as I want to like Timothy Oliphant here, he's just not on par with the first two or even three of the Die Hard villains.
No. Yeah, and part of it, like, I don't know if villain.
It's because of the script.
It's because of the script, but I also think, and to be honest, I think because him being kind of a younger actor with a younger director, they kind of followed the script. Whereas I think Alan Rickman was allowed to kind of own it. Even though it was his first movie, he was a tremendous stage actor. And obviously, the other guy. Jeremy Irons. Obviously a stage actor, but also a wealth of film behind him. I get the feeling they were allowed to add a lot of that texture to make those characters become so much more vibrant than this kind of a cardboard cutout of a villain.
Right.
And that's why I think when you see little moments, like, that's just a reaction. That's just Timothy Oliphant acting through a kind of flat character. I wish he had been able to have some, and who knows, maybe he did, but I wish he had had a little more creative control to bring a sense of likability. I think that's the thing I liked about Alan Rickman. Is even though he's a bad guy, you kind of found him charming and almost likable, you know? He's a great villain, but you realize you like him. You don't detest him the whole time. And even sure. Jeremy Irons, you almost admire how well he's thought this out, you know?
That's right. In this one, you don't feel that. That's the problem.
Yeah, you never feel anything other than, okay, you're the bad guy, and we can't wait to see you lose.
Right. Exactly. And it's a problem because, again, you want to watch... I think that's one of the things about the Die Hard villains of the original trilogy is that all three of them are people who you can sort of understand what they're doing, and you're slightly torn as to whether you want to let them get through with what they're doing or not.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Stewart on a lesser level than the other two, but still you still understand. You know, here's this this career soldier who decides that, all right, he's had enough with the bureaucracy of things and wants to change things. Again, I don't agree with what he wanted to do, but you can sort of get a bit of an understanding until he, you know, completely goes off the rails and crashes a plane. You know, mm-hmm. At that point, he's not as sympathetic as you would want him to be. Because also the other two are only just, thieves. The brothers are thieves.
Mm-hmm. But you know, the cool thing about it, and I know we're not, and you can't help it. It's a franchise, so we're comparing. I think the reason we also like the first one and the third one a lot, as far as those two villains as thieves, we love seeing how calculated and how it feels like they've almost thought of everything. Had it not been for John McClane, they would have gotten away with it.
That's right.
And I think that's what I like. Whereas you could have put anybody in this movie. It didn't have to be, and you've said it already. I don't know how John McClane factors. I mean, there's not that moment of like, oh, I now know what he's up to. You know, I didn't know in either of the two movies. I kind of assumed in the first one it was a terrorist. It wasn't until like, oh, he's just an exceptional thief, not a common thief.
That's right.
And in the third one, he distracts the whole city with the bomb scare so he could break into, like, the gold reserve. Like, it was brilliant. I remember being in the theater. We talked about it, going, holy crap, I get it now. All the threads are there, and they've kind of – how did we not see it coming? And I love that, where this – it was very predictable.
Yeah. Yeah. Unfortunately, but that's the way it is.
Right.
And then Gabriel looks at Lucy and says, hey, behave, or I will hurt you. And she goes, oh, yeah, let's step outside, just you and me. We'll see you her, too. And he looks at her and goes, you really are his daughter. So I like that because, again, they show us that that Lucy does have some of John's spunk. No question about that with the whole thing. Even though, again, you know, we can debate how long, you know, how much time she really has had growing up in her father's shadow. You know, being that you know, we saw that they got divorced, I think, in 98. So here we're talking almost 10 years later. So how old is Lucy at this point? You know, how much of an effect did John have on Lucy's life to know that she's going to act this way? Again, or unless it's just, you know, completely hereditary and, you know, that would make sort of sense.
You know. I don't know. I think we have to mentally fill in a lot of those gaps because if they weren't together, chances are he didn't have as much influence unless she didn't like her mom and ran away and went to go live with her dad. But they don't really, we don't have a good fleshed backstory.
No, not at all. Which is one of the things that I find a little disappointing in this movie is the fact that in the end, she's just a damsel in distress.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they don't really give her much to do here besides, you know, pretend to be John. That's about it.
Yeah, and she solely exists to give John a reason why he's personally invested in getting her back.
Correct. 100%.
And that's it.
And also because of her, he was in Camden. Yeah. They had to have a reason for him to be there.
Right.
Oh, well, let's put him at Rutgers. Why not? And after she makes his comment, so Gabriel like smirks as if he knows what she's talking about. And then he goes, okay, diarists. And, you know, then he just, like, walks away
mm-hmm.
from the whole thing. And Russo is happy to do this, happy to get ready to deal with this whole thing. And then we get a shot of one of the other goons entering the truck lair, as I call it, where we have Trey in there with the rest of the hackers. And this goon then says to him, he goes, Trey, Gabriel wants to see you. And Trey looks at him and goes, is it that time already? Yeah. Okay. And then he stands up and goes, I'll be back in a second. And you see, like, he takes his laptop and, you know, is acting very, very weirdly in this whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
As he just gets up and walks out. Which, again, this is a very, very strange scene in the movie. We see Casper takes a look at what's going on as he gets up, and we see that there's a total of did you see how many techies are in here after Trey leaves?
You've got, I think it's four.
Yeah, we have four of them in there. Then
yeah, because you got the girl standing behind him, you got the guy sitting in the chair back behind him, and then the other two.
And then you have Casper and one of the other guys, right? And then after Trey leaves,
four.
I love how they have like it looks sort of slow motion as Trey is leaving and looking at this guy as he's walking out. And then mm-hmm. Casper looks over and sees what's going on and he screams and he sees that something strange is going on here. And then the guy just pulls out his gun and starts shooting the techies. And then Casper screams, he goes, no, 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 please, please. And like holds up his hand. And then we get one last shot as they're taking them out. So again, the idea of now killing all of their, you know, it goes along with what they did at the beginning of the movie, you know, that, you know, here they had all these guys that they hired to send them different, hacking programs. And then they just eliminated them all. So why you'd think that these, geeks would have known that's what they did also. You think that they're part of, you think only Trey knows that they went and killed all the other guys mm-hmm. at the beginning or do you, I mean, again, this is all speculation. I have no idea. From what I remember at the beginning of the movie, they didn't do it in secret around everyone. You know, like everyone knew that they were taking these guys out.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. But apparently Casper didn't know.
No. And you know, again, kind of a cliche thing, and a lot of other movies have done this as well. I guess it's time to clean up all loose ends and just kind of limit everybody that would be able to identify, expose, or be in any way compromised, and just they're cleaning house.
That's right. So a lesson for anyone out there, if you're ever hired to do a job here like this, be aware the odds are they're not going to let you in.
Yeah. You might have a much shorter lifespan than expected.
Yes. Exactly. And then we again get to see John and Farrell show up in Lincoln Continental, driving without lights on. He pulls over to the side, and you see that they're next to they've shown up at Woodlawn, and you know he pulls up next to a next to the fence, which we see has a lot of barbed wire and stuff like that. And John, he just gets out of the car nice and silently, and the two of them are lurking around the fence trying to find a way to get in. And then we see that they come up to the fence itself, trying to again look as to a way in. And you know, John then sees the truck layer, and then the next shot shows them already on the other side of the fence. So we have no idea how they just got through it. Maybe they have superpowers that they're able to, you know, completely, you know, do like the Flash, that you just go so fast that you can just you know, move your way through solid objects. I don't know.
Okay, so if you freeze it at the right moment, you can see where the barbed wire, the circles look like they've been interrupted or cut away from one of the sections of fence. But we never see them cut it. We never see them moving through it. And it's such a fast shot, you don't even pay attention.
Okay, I see what you're talking about. Yeah. Interesting. So, I wonder where he got the wire cutters.
I don't know. But here's the other thing. Notice how those are parallel bars. Now, I guess the two of them could, if they're fairly still fit, they could probably fit through one of those. So why did they cut the wires for both the middle and the bottom? It's not like they could go through the bar. They're either going to go through the bottom or through the middle, but they're not going to go through both.
That's right. That is a great question. I have no answer to that.
And you know, I get the feeling, and maybe that's the problem with the movie. I have a feeling, and this has always been my criticism. My wife hates when I look at the running time of a movie. I said, babe, I'm telling you, it's almost universal. There is very few exceptions. If the movie is cut to be right at or right under 90 minutes, anywhere from, let's say, 87 to 93 minutes, it's because the producers realize we better get a lot of playing time the opening weekend, because when word gets around that it's not as good as we wanted it to be, they're not going to come see it. So we need maximum exposure during the weekend. So you can't have a 2.5 or 3 hour movie because you only get limited show times. You cut it down to 1.5 hours, you can get a lot more show times in a day.
Okay, but this movie is 2 hours and 8 minutes. So that doesn't fit 100% into that. Die Hard 5.
Is it really? I thought it was 90. I felt like a short movie. I'm sorry.
Nope. At this point, we are at the 93 minute.
Oh, you're right. You're right. I don't know what I was thinking. I thought it was a shorter, for some reason. I thought it was only 1.5 hours.
No, Die Hard 5 is...
That's five.
...is an hour and 40 minutes, an hour and 41 minutes, which, again, that would fit into what you said completely.
Yeah. Okay. I'm mixing that up. My bad. Still, what I was going to say about that is, when you start seeing any time a film feels like it's been cut down, you wonder how many scenes they cut to try to get it to a shorter running time, like clipping the wires or explaining how they got from one location to another.
But again, I like that you caught that. I didn't catch the fact that the barbed wire was cut in the back, but you were 100% right. There's no reason why they would have had to cut both of them. Unless they cut the first one and then said, oh, crap, we can't get through this. And then they went down into the lower one. I don't know.
Yeah, it's clunky at best.
Yes. And then they show them, you know, going down stairs, and then they're going down the ladder. Again, makes no sense, the geography of the whole thing. And then Russo is looking at a screen, and then he goes, "We're showing a breach." Now, again, they didn't have a breach when they went through the barbed wire. They didn't have a breach when they went down the stairs. But now that they're coming down the ladder, that's when the breach comes.
I guess, you know, they didn't need motion detectors or anything else. The other thing is, where's the cameras then? If you've got motion detectors covering an area to give you a warning, where's your cameras?
Yeah. All right. And he says, we're showing a breach on an external vent. You know, again, external, they're inside the compound. So I don't know. And then Gabriel sends him and says, go take a look. Don't be long.
Again, this is where, hey, as a writer, I can write this. That doesn't mean it makes sense.
That's right. And I love when we get a quick shot of Lucy as this is all happening, that she notices something's going on here. She, wait, you're talking about an external vent? Oh, that must be my dad. You know, he likes climbing through vents.
He has a history. And then, you guys know about the Nakatomi Plaza?
That's right. Well, he knows about it. And again, we talked about this earlier. He knows not only about the Nakatomi Plaza, he knows about the fact that John saved the airport in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
Even though it took place in Washington, D.C. But in this movie, they show that it took place in Chicago. Which you got a commendation from the Chicago Police Department for saving the people in the airport in Chicago.
Mm.
Maybe that was just another movie that we didn't
poor writing. I keep coming back to that. It's poor writing.
Yeah. And then Gabriel looks at his watch and goes, "We're packing up soon." And at this point, again, a quick shot of Lucy looking up, knowing that, okay, Dad's on his way.
Mm-hmm.
And then we're back with John and Farrell. And, they come down the ladder and they land on the ground, wherever they are. And at this point, we basically have Farrell go, "Hey, McClane, do we have anything resembling a plan or anything?" I guess it's like the script of the movie, isn't it? That there isn't anything resembling a plan or anything. And John's response is, "Find Lucy and kill everyone else." I mean, more like a plan, like a way to do that. And then John just looks at him and he goes, "Come on."
Mm.
So I guess the answer to that is no.
Right. Oh, yeah, I got a plan. I'm just going to kill everybody.
That's right.
That's the plan, huh?
You just stay behind me and I'm going to just kill everyone in front of us. And that's it.
Look, I read ahead to the script. I survived, so don't worry about it.
That's right. I know that in 6 years they're going to make another Die Hard movie, so I'll be fine. And then they keep going deeper and deeper into the dragon's lair. You know, they start moving, and then Farrell goes, "Okay, according to the layout, the chilling towers are kept at the bottom level." And they keep going down, further through the whole thing. And John, they get to a point where they have to open up like a cellar door. And John easily lifts his up, and then Farrell tries to lift his up and can't do it, and goes, "I think mine's locked."
Yeah.
Again, showing he's somewhat of a weakling, and then the next shot shows that both sides are open, which means I guess John helped him with that one. Another, snippet to try and help out with the editing of the movie.
Yeah, they also started doing this to make it, I guess, more, and this is a technique for filming, but, you're seeing the camera do these kind of motion arounds, or the camera's doing movement to make it feel like there's more going on. They get to the bottom of the ladder, and just as they get to the bottom, I don't have a problem with the pan above, but it's like the camera's behind McClane, and then it swings around to in front of him, and then he's going to go the opposite way where the camera just was. So it's kind of like, it's moving, and then it's going to do it again when they're at the console. It's like, I notice it as like, why are we doing like this kinetic camera movement? Are we trying to make it seem more action-y given they're not doing anything besides talking?
Right. Yeah, because they want to make it seem as if something more is going on.
It's for me, I end up getting distracted when I see stuff like this. It's sort of the Michael Bay style of moving the camera constantly. Like you can't have a locked camera. Everything, camera's got to be moving. Go over a shoulder, come back around, swing around, do a turnaround shot. Come up from above, come from below. It's like, okay, calm down. We don't, relax. Put the camera in place and let's just watch the guys move.
Right.
And it's a technique, and that's fine. It's just it's distracting to me when all of a sudden it feels like it's unmotivated. You're doing a car chase. You're doing an action sequence. Fine. Have the camera be as kinetic as you want. You're just walking to a panel and talking to one another. I don't know why the camera needs to slide all around.
Right.
But anyway, okay. That's about it for that for me.
And then John grabs some sort of tool on the way. Maybe it looks like a wrench or something like that.
It looks like a giant plumber's wrench, like massive.
That's right.
Like a pipe wrench. It's a pipe wrench. It's basically it's just a giant adjustable pipe wrench.
Right. And then at this point, Farrell says, "Okay, now it looks like we're getting somewhere. This looks like it controls the cooling system for the mainframe, which should be, if I can just hack in, trip the alarm, it might alert Bowman." Yeah, well, one second, if you're tripping the alarm, you're going to be alerting the bad guys also, as he's like looking at all these, you know, computers with all these lights flashing. You know, this is like a typical Star Trek shot, you know, where you have all these, you know, lights just blinking on and off, not really telling as much. And then, you know, they look at the console again, doesn't show us much, but then he's able to pull out his handy, roll up keyboard in order to try to figure something out, you know, but again, I don't really buy the logic that let's set off the alarm so that Bowman knows where we are, as opposed to, you know, let's set off the alarm so that Gabriel and his men know that we're here.
Mm-hmm.
And then he like hooks himself up and just starts, you know, typing a whole bunch of stuff, and we see that there's a turbine failure in Tower 7, you know, is basically the way that this segment ends. You know, again, it's a busy screen, but nothing is really happening.
Mm-hmm.
You know, which is pretty annoying and upsetting, but you know. That's what you get from when you go beyond the trilogy.
Mm-hmm. It's and you know, fine if you're also besides the camera movement, you're going to do a lot of quick cuts, showing me plugging it into the USB outlet or whatever. You're right. Going to show a picture of the screen, then a back up to him, then the camera swings over the shoulder, then back to, and it's just like bang 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 bang. And it, I get it; it's a technique to make it feel like there's more. It's like a more frenetic, like the urgency. But they're not acting. I mean, now I feel like I'm nitpicking, but it bugged me. Because I guess maybe if I'm paying attention to that, you know the story's lagging.
Right. It's true. All right. Did you have anything else you wanted to say about this segment?
No, I think we got that 5 minutes done and in the books.
Exactly. All right. So our segment today is Top Cop, where my guests will give their top five police detectives police officers, detectives, however you want to call it.
Mm-hmm.
So why don't you start with your number five and work your way up?
All right, number five. I'm going to go with an Agatha Christie favorite and several movies. A lot of actors have played it, but Hercule Poirot.
Okay, you have a favorite of any of them?
Probably Murder on the Orient Express.
Okay.
Which I remember being a kid going, I'm sorry. I like the original. I mean, Kenneth Branagh is phenomenal, but I think because I already knew the twist because I'd seen the original, it didn't hit me as hard as when I was a younger person watching the original and he put together, and I'm not going to give a spoiler if you've never seen Murder on the Orient Express, but the hardest thing to figure out is why the different kinds of wounds, like, and when he finally puts it all together as a younger person watching, I was like, holy crap. Talk about the ultimate whodunit. A lot of who's.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. Okay. That was number five then. Hercule Poirot. Number four. I know, granted, only two movies with this character, but I loved the creation of a Kentucky Fried Chicken Foghorn Leghorn style detective. Benoit Blanc from the Glass Onion / Knives Out series. Daniel Craig. If you've never seen those two movies, I love his character. So I don't know if you'll accept these because these were episodic cable shows, but my number three was Bosch, which was the show that had, you know, full-length television, but it was all episodic. It was very film-like because it wasn't TV. The character Harry Bosch, they did, I think, 7 or 8 seasons of him as the detective, and then he went and became a private detective after being after resigning from the force in L.A. Phenomenal series based on books by same guy who wrote the Lincoln Lawyer. Very, very good writer, and it just escaped me, the guy who created Bosch. Number two, you already mentioned, or at least I have mentioned you before, is Columbo. I think even though those were ABC movies of the week, I loved it, and I still to this day go back and watch Columbo episodes or movies because they are all standalone, and yet it's the same thing. We're going to show the bad guy commit the crime in the first 5 minutes, and then we spend the rest of the movie seeing if Columbo was going to figure it out.
He was going to figure it out, not if. Mm-hmm. He almost always did.
And my number one, and I probably because I've always loved him in every iteration, and if we have to pick a movie, we can go with the more recent ones. But Sherlock Holmes. Is there a better detective in the history of detectives than Sherlock Holmes?
Oh, well, that is a great choice. You were actually the first person this entire season to mention Sherlock Holmes.
How the heck? I mean, I have loved the character of Sherlock Holmes so much. I mean, I watched everything from the reinvention. There was a TV series for a long time that kind of puttered out that was just phenomenal. I loved the BBC version. I loved the two movies that were done with Jude Law and Iron Man.
Those are movies. They weren't a TV show with Robert Downey Jr.
Right, but those were movie versions. But still, every iteration of Sherlock Holmes, I love.
Okay.
There has not been even the Netflix series. They did a thing about the Sherlock Holmes' younger sister. And I love all those. I mean, everything that I've always loved that character.
Very cool. All right. So then we now have the daily segment that I do every day called State Your Motto. Okay. So the idea here is that the name of this movie is Live Free or Die Hard, which mm-hmm. is the Live Free or Die is the state motto of the state of New Hampshire, which obviously has no connection to this movie whatsoever. But so what I decided to do was I'm making up a little game that every day I will choose a different state and I will give you 3 choices and you have to guess which is the real state motto of that state. Okay. Now each of these mottos that I'm going to use are real mottos. It's just a question of whether it's for that particular state or not. So
gotcha. So it could be real, but not associated with that state.
It's not that it could be real. It is real.
Yeah. Okay.
Yes, they are real. So what state do you think the first state I'm choosing for you?
Oh, are you going to do Michigan or Georgia?
Georgia.
Because I've got Georgia. Georgia. Okay.
Okay.
I know what it is.
Well, let's see. So remember, these are state mottos. These aren't like the state. This isn't what you have on the license plate and things like that.
Right. It's not the peach state, even though everybody calls Georgia the peach state. I'm assuming that's what you mean.
Exactly.
Okay.
Right. Okay. So option A, forward. Option B, wisdom, justice, and moderation, or C, united in pride and hope.
No, it's B. It's wisdom, justice, moderation.
Exactly. Excellent.
It's called the three pillars of our state seal.
There you go.
Yeah. I do know that. I do know my state.
All right. Well, we'll find out over the next few days whether you know other states also.
Okay. Oh, we only do one today. Okay.
We only do one today. We do one every day.
Gotcha. All right. All right. Cool.
All right. So
that was fun. I'm one for one then.
You're one for one. Excellent. You're doing well so far. All right. So, Alan, would you like to tell everyone where they can find you?
Yeah, sure. If you are interested in a show that tries to condense the news of the day, especially more of the national news, political news, obviously I'm live in the U.S., so it's a U.S.-based news talk politics show, but you can find The Alan Sanders Show wherever you find your great podcast. Just look for The Alan Sanders Show. Comes out every single weekday, and love doing what I do. It is political, but I do think sometimes we need to talk about what's going on in the world.
All right. right. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Route Minute. You can find me on Facebook. You can find me on Twitter. You can find me on Instagram. You can find me on my website, movierobminute.com. And if you feel like sending me an email, you can send it to movierobminute@movierob.net. So, until tomorrow, yippee-ki-yay!
Yippee-ki-yay!
Some folks are born made to wave the flag. Oh, they're red, white, and blue, yeah. But it ain't me, it ain't me. I ain't no fortunate one.